From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation this week. Coming up, we'll take a meeting with Irwin Winkler, one of Hollywood's most successful and varied producers, whose credits range from all the Rocky films to Raging Bull and The Right Stuff. He says the most memorable image from the Rocky sagas was an afterthought, and that if you really want to work in films, forget about going to film school. Also today, I speak with Danny Farrington about the art of guitar making. Farrington's instruments are commissioned and played by musicians such as Waylon Jennings, Eddie Van Halen, and Elvis Costello. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a historic Library of Congress recording with composer and pianist Béla Bartók. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video of the 1935 comedy classic Ruggles of Red Gap. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The film Rocky made Sylvester Stallone a star, but it also made the film's producers Robert Chartoff and Irwin Winkler very happy. They were able to take their homes out of hock into which they'd put them to finish the film. But financial arrangements are just part of the producer's life. My guest today is producer Irwin Winkler, who along with Chartoff produced some of the most imaginative films of the past 20 years, from Point Blank to Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, and Round Midnight. Some of their films made tremendous amounts of money, some have not, but the filmmakers took risks which created some startling and compelling movies. They've garnered 11 Academy Awards and 38 nominations. The latest film Irwin Winkler produced, Betrayed, is directed by Costa Gavras, and it opens August 26th. It's a political thriller set in America's fields of waving grain. The Midwest farmers are unhappy with the political forces in the country, and we see the inklings of a white supremacist conspiracy to bring down the government. Apparently good-hearted Americans fear the country is infected with what they call Jews, faggots, and Orientals. The film is a political statement and a thriller, and stars Deborah Winger and Tom Berenger. Irwin Winkler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How'd you first get the idea of doing a film on white supremacists?
Well, I happened to read a story in the Los Angeles Times some years ago, and it was a reporter had gone undercover and had infiltrated a terrorist group, a very, very extreme right-wing group up in Northern California. And it was a very, very short article recounting his experiences while he was with this particular group. And it intrigued me. And then about the same time, I read about the Alan Berg murder. He was the talk show host in Denver that was murdered on his way home from the station one night. And it turned out that he was murdered by a group of right-wing when I say right wing, by the way, I mean really extremist right wing. Nothing. We have no statement or no feelings as far as any political reasons against any right wing thinking.
You're talking almost about paramilitary organizations.
Exactly. These are modern day Ku Klux Klanners, and I say modern day because I think we all still have the vision of Ku Klux Klanners as men that ride around in white robes over their face. These are people that are very seemingly ordinary, that they're our neighbors next door. They're a lot more dangerous because they don't wear any Nazi badges on their uniforms. Anyhow, I got the it all kind of came together with the Berg murder. That interested me a great deal. We started to do some research, and as we dug into it, we found that it was a story that was perking underneath the consciousness of almost all thinking Americans. However, it was a story that never was on page one of the major newspapers. The stories always seemed to be on page eight, somewhere in the back of the page.
What about Costa Gavras appealed to you, a Greek-born, French-resident director, to do a film about the American heartland?
Well, he's somebody that's always been in the forefront of political thinking, whether it was Latin America as far as Missing is concerned, or the film that won the Academy Award that he directed many years ago called Z, which dealt with the Greek generals in Greece, which is his own native country. And other films such as State of Siege, which dealt with the Argentinian terrorists. And Costa's had a long history of involvement with political subjects. So he seemed to be a natural for me to approach.
But there also seems to be a political sensibility that you have as a producer that runs as a theme through many of your films. What themes appeal to you as a producer that you'd like to see up there on the screen?
Well, I don't think it's the themes themselves that appeal to me. It's really the characters. I'm constantly, as someone pointed out some years ago, almost all my films are about the same thing, and that is how people respond to in a particular situation. Whether it's Rocky and the way he responds when he's given an opportunity to fight and for the championship, or it's Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, how he responds. Or it's Chuck Yeager and how he responds to his situation. Or Jane Fonda responds to the pressure that she did in one of my earlier films called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And this is a theme, again, of how the character that Deborah Winger plays responds to her situation. And so the political aspects aside, I seem to be more interested in the characterization and how these people respond in a pressure situation. Some respond well, some don't, obviously.
How much of this is a reflection of your own experience in life as a film producer? There was a time when you began producing films where you really had to struggle. You barely had airfare to get to London to take a look at your first film.
Yeah.
The making of Rocky was a great struggle for you to make.
Well, Rocky was a... Yeah, nobody wanted to make Rocky, and Bob Chartoff and I ended up investing a lot of our meager resources, and believe me, they were meager at the time. I wouldn't tell my wife what we had invested of our own, you know, few dollars to make that picture. Yes, it was a struggle for many, many years, and the struggle now is not a financial one. The struggle now is to make films that will somehow entertain people, but also say something to people, maybe move them a little bit. And I think what we're trying to do is make films that not have a message per se, but are worth spending 2 hours in the theater for somebody to see, but also spending an hour, a year of your life in making it. Why invest a year into something that's frivolous?
You came to this idea of making Betrayed while you were actually working on Round Midnight.
Right.
The story of Bud Powell, which starred Dexter Gordon. You were shooting in Paris at the time. How frequent is it that you're working ahead on projects while you're in the midst of another one?
Well, not too much. It's an interesting story. Around Midnight is because it Marty Scorsese and I were returning from Israel, where we were looking for locations for The Last Temptation of Christ, because I was the original producer. I bought the book from the Kazantzakis estate and financed the Paul Schrader screenplay, and was involved in making the film. So Marty and I were returning from Israel, where we were looking for locations, and he said that Bertrand Tavernier had admired some of the things I had done and wanted to meet me, and we all had lunch together. And Bertrand and I started talking about our mutual love for jazz, and that film came out of that luncheon. Interesting enough, if you remember Around Midnight, we used Marty Scorsese as the New York agent for Dexter Gordon.
Well,
so it all comes around. And last night I saw The Last Temptation of Christ, as a matter of fact, at its screening.
Now, I want to ask you about that. Do you regret no longer being the producer of that film?
Yeah, I always regretted it. But what happened is we were right in the midst of the right stuff, and we just couldn't do both at the same time. They both came together at the same time. The right stuff was a big commitment of time and energy. The logistics of making that film were very, very difficult. And we just couldn't let that one go and just jump on to Last Temptation. So we sat down with Marty, and we worked with him as long as we could on it. And when we were physically unable to do so, we bowed out. And we're still close friends. As a matter of fact, the next film that I produce is Marty is going to direct it, as a matter of fact. So,
what will that be?
It's a film by Nick Pileggi. It's called Wise Guys right now, but it's we're going to have to change the title because it's a television series by the same name.
But that's the story of a guy who's told all about the mafia and his sort of low-level experience in it. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And that we're going to start in March or April, in the spring.
Well, I want to go back a bit to The Last Temptation of Christ.
Okay.
There's a great deal of brouhaha about the film and people saying it's made Jesus far too human. Could you sort of sense this as a controversy that was coming when you and Martin Scorsese were first working on the project?
Well, yeah, I knew something was brewing because people were constantly misunderstanding whatever Marty had planned to do. As a matter of fact, after seeing the film last night, it's what I always felt in the screenplay and certainly always felt in the Kazantzakis book, and that was that this was an affirmation of Christ rather than a... people say it's a humanization of Christ. That may be so. I think this, what it is really is an affirmation of faith on the part of Marty, and it's a very, very moving portrayal of Christ. And I dare say if the people that are critical of it have seen the film or had seen the film, they would be certainly a lot less critical of it. I think the public will speak for themselves. It's a very, very moving, important motion picture.
And isn't all this protest really a wonderful windfall for the producer?
I don't know. I can't say. I think the film stands on its own. I think if they had had it to do over again, I think they would probably have avoided it because the attacks have become very personal. They've become anti-Semitic in a great sense of the word. And I think that's unfortunate. I think Marty has handled it very well. I think the studio Universal has handled it very well. And I think the right wing is, the Jerry Falwells, who make speeches claiming the blasphemy of the movie without having seen it, is very unfortunate.
My guest is movie producer Erwin Winkler. His new project is the Costa Gavras film Betrayed, which is set in the world of white supremacists in the Midwest. Winkler's other films include Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, Round Midnight, and all four Rocky films. Any plans to make a Rocky V?
Yeah, we were just talking about it this morning. We think we have a good story. Sylvester has been working on it for the last couple of months, and we're planning it. Yes, we're going to do a Rocky V.
Anything you can say about it as far as its setting?
Well, I think we're going to go back to some of the earlier qualities that Rocky had in the very first film. I think it's going to be... I think it's going to deal with the human condition and where a man is at in his own life rather than extolling the virtues of the body beautiful.
Well, that was one of the appeals of Rocky. It captured also Philadelphia rough and raw, and Rocky, the film, had that sort of look to it. And it was part of a whole movement of regional films that really kind of paid homage to different parts of the country. It got the movie industry out of L.A.
Right. One of the people that we had offered the film to when we were trying to get the financing for it said, "You mean to say you want to make a film in Philadelphia? Nobody goes to Philadelphia." Well, we had a good time in Philadelphia, and a lot of people go to Philadelphia, and there's a lot of good reasons to go there.
You know, one of the most memorable scenes of Rocky turned out to be almost an accident, an afterthought, which was where Rocky runs up the stairs of the Philadelphia Museum of Art and throws his fists in the air, cheering and overlooking the whole city of Philadelphia. How much of what makes great moments in movies is accidental? How much of it is right there on the screenplay that you can see as you turn the page?
Well, that was an accident. That was an idea. It wasn't an accident, but it was an idea that Sylvester and John Avildsen had at the last moment. We were shooting in Philadelphia and heading back towards some shooting in New York, and I left on late Friday afternoon. The company was supposed to leave that night, and I stopped off in New York to see my family on the way out to L.A., and Avildsen and Stallone came up with this idea of running up and down the stairs, and they couldn't find me, so they found Bob Chartoff, and it was kind of an off-the-cuff thing, and they said, "Do you think we could do it?" And he asked how much it would cost, and it wasn't very expensive, and he said, "Go ahead and shoot it," and there it was. And then Bill Conti came up with this great score for that scene, and... it was an accident because it wasn't planned, but it was somebody's idea to make it all work, and that's never accidental because after the raw footage came in, somebody had to know what to do with it, and a lot of people jumped in and were able to do that.
You made Rocky One for what, about $1 million at the time?
Yep, just about a little over $1 million. Yes.
How much would it cost you to make that movie today? Same conditions.
Well, I mean, if I still paid Sylvester Stallone $75,000, that same film, excluding the salaries of the stars, probably would cost about $12 to $13 million, excluding the salary of the stars.
Mm. And you would have probably had an even more difficult time convincing anyone to underwrite it.
Yeah, it's always tough to convince people to finance things that are a little different. As a matter of fact, when I get into a situation where somebody is free with their money on something that I want to do and there isn't any difficulty in raising the financing, I'm going to question it a great deal, because then I think you're walking into a trap. I think you have to try to be innovative. You have to try to be different. There's nothing wrong with making Rocky 2, 3, and 4. What's right about it is making Rocky 1, is finding a subject that people tell you is of no interest, that there's somebody involved in the production, in this case the actor, that nobody wants and nobody's interested in, and making that work. That's exciting, and that's what filmmaking should be. It should be a little bit innovative. It should try to take some chances. If it stops taking chances, the chances are that you're going to get boring and not very original.
There's a line in Rocky that I like that I think speaks to this, and that's where the bartender turns to Rocky and says, "Me, I got a business to run. I don't take no shots." And that seemed almost sort of a metaphor for the way some Hollywood producers behave, almost on the safe side.
Well, yeah, I think it's a metaphor for life, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the truth about a lot of people.
I'm speaking with Hollywood producer Irwin Winkler. He produced the new Costa Gavras film, Betrayed. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Irwin Winkler is my guest. During his long career in Hollywood, he produced Elvis Presley's Double Trouble, worked with Martin Scorsese on Raging Bull and New York, New York, and watched his regional independent film, Rocky, turn into one of Hollywood's biggest success stories. He's just produced a new film by Costa Gavras called Betrayed, which is a thriller set among white supremacists in the American Midwest. Raging Bull, another boxing film he made starring Robert De Niro, is an entirely different kind of boxing film. I mean, I guess boxing is pretty much a sport about a story of domination. And what appealed to you about the script that was so different from the way the Rocky story went?
Well, the approach to Raging Bull was quite different than Rocky, obviously. The approach there was, as far as we were always concerned, we were doing a buddy film, probably the underside of the buddy film. But we were really trying to examine the relationship between Jake LaMotta and his brother, and how violence in the ring becomes a factor in the violence of life. That there's no way to separate your life in the ring from your life away from the ring. Jake turns out to be a man who is examined very, very carefully under a microscope in the nature of his relationship to his brother. I don't know if a lot of people saw that, because the film had its own life and its own meaning to a lot of people. But that's what we started out to do. We started out to examine both these men and how they affected each other.
What about the choice of shooting it in black and white? Was this a producer's decision, a director's decision? How did you and Martin Scorsese discuss this?
Well, somebody mentioned it and had the idea, I don't recall who, and we all thought it was kind of interesting, because we wanted to do a in some way a homage to you know, the film noirs of the 40s and 50s, and it's just something that just generated amongst us, and we talked about it, and it seemed like a good idea. Again, we had a great deal of difficulty with the financiers because of that. Again, the story was that you know, television stations won't want to play it because it's in black and white and all that stuff. And then I think Woody Allen did a film in black and white at just about that time, and it was fairly successful, and suddenly nobody objected that violently to it anymore.
What was that? That was Manhattan, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, how much trouble do you have with financiers? I mean, in Hollywood, the pitch is notorious. It's legendary. I mean, people are always pitching ideas to one another. What is the producer's pitch to the financiers? How do you try to sell them on a film that you're making?
You know, each film really has to be sold on its own merits or lack of merits. I don't know how I do it, really. It's always difficult. Betrayed, we really sold it because it was a film that was a thriller. We had found an original way to present a character in a very, very tense situation, and which has always been the background of the film. We had very little trouble on Betrayed. Usually there's a great deal more difficulty. The studio was very anxious, United Artists in that case, was very anxious to do it because they thought that there was a good market for this kind of film.
How much are movies nowadays driven by marketing? I mean, are you susceptible to the pressure to use screenings to test endings and to test content of a film?
Oh, yeah, we're not immune to it. It's becoming research is becoming a crutch for most of the studios, and it's a crutch based on the lack of show business experience and the lack of trusting their own instincts. There is no, you know, when you get lawyers and accountants running companies, they don't trust any creative instinct, and what they want to do is go by numbers. And research is easy because you get back numbers. 7 people say they don't like this scene, 4 people say they like that ending. And you could put it up on a chart and you could say, well, this is what we should do. So I think sometimes the research works for marketing, but as far as making films are concerned, if we're not careful, we're going to send our stories out to research before we even write them. I dare say if you did a research study and you said, well, we have this film about this overweight Italian bum in Philadelphia who breaks arms for a living and improbably gets a shot at the world championship and then loses, they'll say to you, well, I'll tell you what, research tells us that women don't like to see films of violence. Boxing has been banned in a great deal of the European countries. Japan, sumo wrestling is the big indoor sport. His girlfriend is an ugly duckling by the name of, played by Talia Shire. There's absolutely no way. Your music is going to be done by Bill Conti, who is a jazz pianist in a bar in Venice. This is what you want us to, in Philadelphia? And you want to star Sylvester Stallone? Come on. Research will tell you you're crazy. Nobody's going to go see this movie.
How do you fight that trend now? I mean, are you under pressure to do that? Do people should show Betrayed in a theater and turned in responses?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Thank God the response has been good, so the pressure hasn't been too bad. But sure, you can't avoid the financier saying, look, we've invested $12 or $13 million, and you know, we'd like to run it in a theater and see how it plays. In this case, the film has played very well, so we haven't had a lot of feedback. If it hadn't played well, we might have gotten a different kind of response.
Your early work in the show business industry was with the William Morris Agency, mm-hmm. working as an agent and also as a clapper. What is a clapper?
Well, what I did in the early, I used to get $5 for going to television shows and clapping, literally cheering. At a bad joke that wasn't getting a response, I would applaud or laugh and try to create some more reaction amongst my fellow audience members. And I worked 2 shows a week, and I got $10 a week doing that.
And then what took you into the big time?
I guess now we have canned applause, so canned. I guess it's the same.
Saves on the money, right.
Yeah.
What took you into the world then of movie producing? How did you get from being a clapper into working on films?
Well, that's a long story. It'll take more than 40 minutes to tell that story.
Uh-oh. Well, let me ask you a question then. I understand one of your early projects was originally designed for Julie Christie, but somehow the Hollywood studio said, no, actually, it's more suitable as a vehicle for Elvis Presley?
That's right. We had met the president of MGM. His name was Robert O'Brien, and I guess that was about 1965. And we had the script, and we gave it to him to read, and he said, "Oh, I think this is a terrific script, and but I don't think it's right for Julie Christie. I'd like to do it with Elvis Presley." And we were very anxious. We said, "Gee, what a great idea!" And before we knew it, we were on a an airplane out to Hollywood producing a film with Elvis Presley.
And that was before audiences measured their responses to... That's
right. But I'll tell you, there's a sad story about Elvis Presley, who I didn't know well, but I knew him enough. We spent 6 months making a film together. He was a terrific, very, very nice young man. I say young man, I think he was older than I am, but he was a very nice person. And the thing I remember the most about Presley was... His career was already starting to head towards a twilight as far as films were concerned, and he had surrounded himself with, I guess there were 30-some-odd in his entourage, guys that would just bring him a towel when he sweated and a guy that would bring him a cold glass of water when he wanted that. And all of them had Cadillac cars, as I remember it, and they had a good thing going, and I remember... as they would head out the studio at the end of the day, he had this big limousine. I think it was a Rolls Royce. I didn't know much about Rolls Royces in those days, but I think it was a Rolls Royce. And they used to, as they approached the gates of MGM, they used to say to Elvis, "Okay, get down now." And he'd get down on the floor of the car, and they'd throw this big rug over him. And they'd do that so that the crowds outside wouldn't attack him. The sad thing about that was there were no more crowds outside, but Elvis never really knew it because he was always under that blanket. And to me, it's the sad story of Elvis Presley. He never knew they weren't out there anymore.
That's a terrifying story about Hollywood.
Yeah, it is.
What do you think is a producer's greatest virtue, or at least your greatest virtue?
The greatest virtue a producer has is an ability to read and maybe write a little bit. But if I had to give an abject lesson in producing, I'd say don't go to film school. I wouldn't recommend anybody ever going to film school, by the way. I would say learn how to read and write. Read the classics. Read some good Russian literature. Read the American classics. Get a good background in classical literature because you better learn how to know a good story from a bad one.
What's on your bedstand at the moment for your reading material?
Naming Names, a book about the blacklisting in Hollywood in the 50s, and I'm reading the Kazan book, My Life.
Yeah, it's a study of character.
Kazan's apology for naming names ties right into the book of Nevasky's, which deals with the Hollywood blacklisting of the 50s.
And that gets back to your interest in study of character.
Yep, and it's probably going to be the next film I do, as a matter of fact.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, and I appreciate you taking
the time.
Well,
it's a pleasure.
Erwin Winkler's new film, Betrayed, is scheduled to open on August 26th. It's directed by Costa Gavras and stars Deborah Winger and Tom Berenger. It's a thriller that looks into the world of violent white supremacists in the American Midwest. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Kay Mills. She's a writer for the Los Angeles Times, and she's just published a book on the history of women newspaper reporters called A Place in the News. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Guitar maker Danny Farrington treats his craft as an art, but if a rock star wants the guitar to match his girlfriend's lipstick, he doesn't think that compromises his craft. Coming up, we meet Danny Farrington, who Linda Ronstadt says builds guitars that sound and look like extensions of the musicians who play them. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a CD reissue of a 1940 concert recording featuring composer Béla Bartók and violinist Joseph Szigeti. They perform works of Beethoven, Debussy, and Bartók. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of the classic comedy Ruggles of Redcap, about a proper English butler who tries to bring civility and manners to the Wild West. Ken says that after 50 years, the humor holds up and works on the home screen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. In Burma today, protesters took to the streets for the third straight day of violent demonstrations against the government of Sein Lwin. According to Radio Rangoon, 33 people were killed today. Christopher Gunnis reports.
Three policemen in separate incidents in the northern sector of Rangoon were dragged from their quarters by angry crowds and brutally murdered. According to reports, they were beheaded. In other incidents, a soldier and a man suspected of being a government informer were killed by demonstrators. A police sergeant in Rangoon is reported to have been kidnapped. There are no further details. In another incident outside Rangoon General Hospital, security forces opened fire when crowds attacked a military vehicle. There are also reports of violence in the town of Mulmain in the eastern sector of Burma. Crowds attacked a police station and looted guns and ammunition. Shooting followed, in which one policeman was killed. Later, senior police officers and Buddhist monks appealed to the demonstrators to surrender weapons, and eventually the protesters complied.
The BBC's Christopher Gunnis. At this hour, the Senate is voting on a democratic plan to provide the Nicaraguan Contras with $27 million in humanitarian aid. The Republicans had proposed a rival plan that would provide military as well as humanitarian assistance, but it was defeated earlier today in the Senate. The Democratic plan delays any decision on sending weapons to the Contras. At a special session of the Israeli Knesset, or parliament, today, Israeli politicians responded to King Hussein's decision 10 days ago to cut his ties to the Israeli-occupied territories. They also responded to signs that Palestinian leaders may soon declare independence or announce a government in exile. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
The session today in the Knesset and in a closed cabinet meeting was bitter. Likud politicians allied with Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir wanted to talk about annexation of the West Bank and Gaza, something the Labor Party and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said would destroy the Jewish people. Likud member of Knesset Yitzhak Modai said that King Hussein, by giving up the West Bank, has removed all of the pressure for Israel to talk to him now. Likud politicians declared their intention to deal harshly with any attempt by Palestinians to unilaterally set up an independent state, symbolic or otherwise. According to Palestinian sources and documents leaked to the media by Israeli secret police, such a declaration is being seriously considered and discussed now that King Hussein has cut ties to the occupied West Bank. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Stock prices fell again today, and experts say the market is beginning to weaken after a summer rally. Yesterday's decision by the Federal Reserve Board to raise the discount rate a half point continued to discourage investment today. But market strategist Al Goldman says the rate hike is only part of the reason the market is in decline.
The market has been acting weak, really, for the last month. Our summer rally of 220 points ended a month ago, and momentum started to deteriorate. So we have negative trends in both the stock and bond market, which says that we haven't found bottom yet.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 45 points to close at 2034. Declining issues outnumbered advances 7-1 on volume of 201 million shares. The nomination of former Pennsylvania Governor Richard Thornburgh was approved today by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thornburgh has been named to replace Edwin Meese as Attorney General. Meese resigned after denying wrongdoing in an investigation into the possible misuse of his influence in behalf of his business associates. The committee approved Thornburgh on a voice vote and then sent his name to the full Senate, where final approval is all but certain. Edwin Meese is expected to leave office later this week. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Béla Bartók is now known primarily as a composer rather than as a pianist, but during his lifetime he was equally respected for his playing. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Bartók in performance with violinist Joseph Zaghetti, a concert played nearly 50 years ago, now out on compact disc.
The friendship of Béla Bartók and violinist Joseph Zaghetti dates back to the 1920s in their native Hungary. Zaghetti was 11 years Bartók's junior and had already admired him for nearly 20 years. Zaghetti was a champion of Bartók's music, some of which Bartók wrote for him, and they gave many chamber performances together all over Europe and even in New York. Both of them were strenuously anti-Nazi. Zaghetti refused to perform in Germany after 1932. Bartók wouldn't allow his music to be broadcast in either Germany or Italy. Perhaps the most important concert they gave together was the one at the Library of Congress in Washington on April 13, 1940, shortly after Zaghetti emigrated to America. Bartók returned to Hungary one last time, but he had already decided to leave. What he called his exile in America began in October 1940 and lasted until his death only 5 years later. This concert, part reunion, part renunciation, is both a personal and a political statement. It's played at white heat with the ebullient abandon of musicians whose knowledge and whose instincts are profound and unerring. The program begins with Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata, and I've never heard a more exciting or heroic version. There's deep understanding of the drama inherent in the first movement sonata form, and of the way the variations of the second movement unfold. The presto finale is one of the great celebrations in music. Bartók and Zaghetti pull out all the stops, yet never lose their sensitivity or rhythmic precision. This is both their cry of joy and their assertion of freedom. This recording shows what a great pianist Bartók was in music other than his own. He never made a studio recording of a large-scale work by any other composer. But here, beside the Beethoven, is also Debussy's extraordinary sonata for violin and piano, one of his last works, completed in 1917. It's an intricate piece, moving and heroic, but in a more glancing, modern way than the Kreutzer. Also, two wonderful works by Bartók himself, the first Rhapsody, which he dedicated to Zaghetti, and the difficult second sonata, which Bartók and Zaghetti played together many times but had never recorded before. They reveal both the conversational intimacy, the playfulness, and the daring adventurousness of this forbidding work. native sound from nearly a half a century ago is warm and vibrant. It's amazing that this recording exists at all. It opens a door to all the legendary great performances of the past. It lets us believe in giants. But there couldn't have been many figures quite as gigantic as these magnificent compatriots.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a sonata recital by Joseph Sigeti and Béla Bartók. It's on the Vanguard record label. This is Fresh Air. Danny Farrington grew up in rural Louisiana, working in his father's cabinet shop and playing the guitar. Today he has his own shop in Los Angeles, where he crafts acoustic guitars with custom shapes and colors. He's made them for traditional musicians such as Ry Cooder, Linda Ronstadt, and Waylon Jennings. Here's Richard Thompson playing his Farrington guitar on the song, How Will I Ever Be Simple Again? And his acoustic guitars are played by more electrified musicians, like heavy metal guitarist Eddie Van Halen, who plays a Farrington guitar on the new Van Halen album, OU812. Before he moved to Los Angeles in 1980, Farrington worked in Nashville at the Old Time Pick and Parlor, a guitar repair shop and after-hours bluegrass club. It was there that he grew bored with the look of the standard acoustic guitar.
I saw pretty quick when I started making acoustic guitars. I made them for most of the country music artists in Nashville. And once I would go to rock and roll shows and show these guys these acoustic guitars, and they would pick it up and they couldn't play it. I mean, they literally couldn't play it. They would, you know, sort of try to play like Bob Dylan or something. They couldn't play. With their electrics, they could play. So I discovered pretty quick that there was something in just the form that acoustic guitar took on that limited the way they played. And I thought if it were a more accessible instrument in that it had a different shape that would appeal to them, it looked more like an electric guitar, that somehow they would warm to it more and it wouldn't be such an alien thing to them.
So in other words, you took the acoustic guitar design and tried to make it look more like an electric so that people who played the electric guitar wouldn't be accused of being folkies?
Well, not necessarily accused of being folky. It's just that you define yourself by everything you surround yourself with. I mean, the way your clothes and your watch and your shoes. And you know, a banker is just not going to wear a pair of pink Reeboks. You know, I mean, those musicians, electric musicians, they play electric guitars. So an acoustic instrument is just so far, it is a folky instrument. So they think you have to be a folky. I mean, they didn't, not that they didn't like it. It's just it just was alien to them.
Speaking of pink Reeboks, I've seen some photographs of your guitars, and they look like hot rods. I mean, they're asymmetrical. They're painted with flames. They're in pink. They're in black. They've got bites taken out of them. Some of them are electric green.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing that what happens is that, you know, the guitars that most guys are offered straight off the counter, you know, you go into a music store, and there are the guitars on the wall, and those are what they have to choose from. Whatever the factories want to give you, that's what you have to choose from. To make money, most guys have to set up and make one particular model over and over and again, and they have their template set up. Well, I completely did it the other way. I wanted to make them completely custom. I wanted to throw every mold out and start again with every guy. So when we sat down to design a guitar, and they realize they can have whatever they want, you know, you'd be surprised what they ask.
Well, it sounds like you like to sit down with the with the musician and say, okay, what do you want in a guitar? What kind of patterns do you want? What kind of designs? What kind of sound do you want? How much of the discussion between you and a guitarist is about the sculpture of the guitar? How much of it is about the musicalness of the guitar, the tone that it makes?
It's all that. I mean, it's such a wonderful give and take. We, you know, draw on paper and they, you know, bring me their girlfriend's lipstick and, you know, we just...
What do you mean they bring you their girlfriend's lipstick?
Everything. I mean,
as a color for a guitar?
Oh, yeah. I had... Stephen Bishop came to my shop and I made him one and he brought me clothes. I mean, he brought me a pair of socks and he brought me a shirt. He brought me an aqua blue shirt and a pair of pink socks. Or maybe it was pink socks and aqua shirt. I can't remember, but it was a couple. It was articles of clothing of his that he really loved those values of, and he'd worn them and liked that look. And Kathy Valentine with the Go-Go's, we went to the Rexall down in Hollywood and went to the lipstick counter and, you know, went through the lipsticks, you know. And I got a tube of lipstick and took it back to my shop to match her guitar to the red. So, you know, it's that personal.
Well, how much do your guitars, if I came to you and said, I want a guitar the color of violet blush lipstick,
and, uh-huh.
How much would one of your guitars cost me? How long would it take to make one?
Well, it just depends. I mean, I really don't have any set price for anything. It's just one of those things I can sort of figure up in my head. I mean, it'd be the difference from doing a piece of pearl inlay that's a dot to a piece of pearl inlay that's shaped like a, you know, a goat head or something. You know, I mean, it in my head I figured out how much time that's going to take me. But you know, a normal guitar, if it's really really plain, you know, around $2,500, something like that. Which I know sounds like a lot for a lot of people, but I really haven't been making, you know, that much money doing these things, I must say. I mean, it takes so much time.
How long would it take to make a guitar?
Well, it takes like, I mean, if it's going to be any kind of pearl inlay at all or any kind of ornament at all, it'd take me a month to make it, you know. So, I mean, that's not that much money when you talk about materials. You know, the rent out here in California is ridiculous, you know. I recently licensed some guitars to Kramer Guitars, so they're manufacturing my guitars now. So I'm actually making money from that, and which is great because I've never really, I mean, I hate to sound glib about this, but I've never really wanted to do this for the money. People always wanted to get into it, and they think I make a lot of money from guitars. I've always told them that it's not a really profitable way to make a living. It's one of those things you really have to do it because you love it. I mean, were it not for the Kramer thing, I really wouldn't make any money at all.
When you make one of these oddly shaped, asymmetrical guitars, star-shaped, wedge-shaped guitars, do you know that it's going to sound good?
Well, yes. I mean, I know it's going to sound good because I'm following, you know, very tried and true guidelines as far as construction, even though the shape is different. As long as the bracing and the thickness of the top and there's enough top surface, there's a certain amount of string tension when you tune a guitar up, and it's going to have a nice tone. I mean, I could put strings on a clipboard. I made a guitar the other day in an hour, and Ry Cooter has it now, and he loves it. He played it on a record and took it on
in
tour
an hour?
Europe.
Hour. How did you make it in an hour?
It's a piece of plywood, and I took a Kramer neck and bolted it on the piece of plywood, and took a bass guitar pickup and screwed it on in a certain position. And Ry loves it. I mean, it completely founds out my theories about it. I mean, if you're a good writer and you sat down and wrote a letter to one of your friends, it would somehow have a construction. It would be a pretty good letter, you know? I mean, it wouldn't... If you really are a craftsman at something, you know, you'd have to really tie one of your hands behind your back or be blindfold to really mess it up.
Have you ever tried other instruments, violins, cellos?
Yeah, I'm working on a string... I'm making a string quartet now.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I've made two violins and a viola.
Are these electric or acoustic?
No, they're acoustic. They're acoustic. They're very odd. They're very odd. I've got some people interested in them and stuff, and I just haven't brought them out of the closet yet. And I want to get the cello made and at least make another couple of violins. And But the shapes are very odd. It's a very modern instrument. I mean, it may be 10 years or it may take my life to get it perfected the way I want it, but it's very different. It's very Brockish, you know, like a Brock painting or something. It's very asymmetrical and askew, but there's still a balance to it. People walk in my shop and they go, "What's that?" And they're very intrigued by it.
Hey, well, I'm delighted you were able to spend some time with us here on Fresh Air today.
Well, thanks a lot. It's nice to meet you, and like I said, I'm really flattered you wanted to talk to me.
Guitar maker Danny Farrington. Here's Ry Cooter playing Farrington's one-hour guitar on a new album by Bobby King and Terry Evans. Yeah, this is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later from National Public Radio. Co-host Robert Siegel is with me on the line. And in the news today, Robert?
Well, we're following an Israeli debate on King Hussein's renunciation of his claim to the West Bank, also the Republican platform discussions in New Orleans where they're preparing for their national convention. We have a special report from John Burnett on the town of Hemphill, Texas. It's a town that is coming to grips with charges of racial injustice, a town that it is said of it that the civil rights movement passed it by 20 years ago. We're also going to have word from Canada. It is virtually a day of grief and mourning up north. You know why?
No.
The Los Angeles Kings have made off with Wayne Gretzky, hockey's greatest player.
Bad news. This and more stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the advantages of the video cassette revolution is that we can see great movies of the past in our own time. Critic Ken Tucker recommends the comedy classic Ruggles of Red Gap, starring Charles Laughton.
50 years after its initial release, Ruggles of Red Gap holds up amazingly well and could serve as a lesson to many current directors on how to film a comedy. The plot of Ruggles is simplicity with profound resonance. An English earl bets his butler in a poker game with an American oil baron and loses. Whisked off to the Old West with his new employer, stiff upper-lipped Ruggles teaches the backslapping Americans a few lessons in civility while learning some things himself about democracy and equality. That makes the movie sound dull and preachy, of course, but working with this basic premise, director Leo McCarey managed to film one of the most boisterous and nervy comedies imaginable. It helps, of course, that Ruggles was played by Charles Laughton, who manages to convey intelligence and sly humor behind that big, soft pudding of a face. In this early scene, the English employer, played with suave dottiness by Roland Young, breaks the news to Laughton that he was the prize in the high-stakes poker game.
You're going out to America.
America, my lord. A country of slavery.
You know, that's all finished, I believe. Some fellow called Pocahontas or something did something about it,
Indeed, my lord. Would it be North or South America, my lord?
Oh, North, I think it is. Somewhere on the West Coast, you know, Idaho or Omaha, one of those Indian places. Chap's a sort of a millionaire.
A chap, my lord?
Yes, plenty of money, you know. Mines, lumber, domestic animals and that sort of thing. His wife took quite a fancy to you and so they won you.
Won me, my lord?
Yes. We were playing this game of drawing poker, you see. Seemed as a thing called bluffing. Though I say it myself, I'm particularly good at it.
The exchanges between Laughton and Roland Young are low-key, sneaky fun, and they provide a contrast to the scenes between Laughton and the actor who plays the loud nouveau riche oil man, whose real name, confusingly enough, is Charlie Ruggles. Over the years, Charles Laughton's performance in this film has taken on a legendary status, but I think anyone watching Ruggles of Red Gap today would also be knocked out by Charlie Ruggles' wonderful, thoroughly sympathetic portrait of a vulgar, ugly American who ends up the ultimate source of wisdom in this fable of class consciousness. 2 years after Ruggles of Red Gap, Leo McCarey made what is probably the most famous screwball comedy of all time, The Awful Truth, with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne. But in its own very different way, Ruggles of Red Gap is just as good a film, one whose generosity of spirit has rarely been matched in the movies. In its video cassette version, the black and white images are crisp and clear, and if anything, watching the movie in the privacy of your own home permits you to catch every muttered witticism, every subtle double take, without the distraction of Revival House guffaws.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at tomorrow's show. On the next Fresh Air, new fame for an old writer. 24 years ago, Hubert Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn shocked readers with its bracing language and portrayals of prostitutes, thugs, and ex-cons along Brooklyn's waterfront. Now, Last Exit to Brooklyn is being filmed, and Selby says more people have wanted to interview him in the last week than in the last 20 years. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Tenement Year, the first album in 6 years by the Cleveland group Per Ubu. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Last Temptation of Christ, the controversial film by Martin Scorsese that depicts a Jesus torn between ordinary humanness and divinity. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.